Hello, welcome back to the Sustainable-ish podcast. I am your host, Jen Gale. It is Good Friday as this episode is going out, so the fortunate amongst you will hopefully be looking forward to a long weekend, and massive thank you to those of you who are working this weekend to keep the wagon on the road. Now, one of the things that frustrates, I think, many people when it comes to all things climate and nature is a lack of action from governments around the world to protect nature and to mitigate the worst impacts of a warming and rapidly changing climate. Now, the UK government for a little while was in full-on self-congratulatory, that's hard to say, backslapping mode, as they were one of the first governments around the world to come up with a net zero target back in 2019, and the same year they declared a climate emergency. And that all sounds great, but the problem with both of those commitments is that they, more often than not, don't really translate into the urgent and radical action that is needed. So in this week's episode, I am delighted to be chatting to Amy McDonald and Oliver Sidorchuk, co-directors of Zero Hour, a campaign that is working to get a new bill, the Climate and Nature Bill, passed into law, which would ensure that UK government policies are in line with the latest science. With an election looming at some point this year, support for this bill in the run-up to that not only shows MPs and prospective MPs that this is an issue that the electorate care about, that their electorate, their constituents care about, it will also mean that the campaign will have the momentum it needs to hit the ground running when a new parliament sits after the new election. Studies repeatedly show that people are concerned about the climate and nature crises, but especially when it comes to politics, and I think especially elections due to our electoral system, it can feel really hard to feel like our vote or our voice is making a difference. Supporting the Climate and Nature Bill is a brilliant and, might I say, incredibly easy way to make your voice heard by your local politicians. And we can then amplify our own individual support for it by asking any businesses and organisations that we're involved with to support it too. It's a really fascinating topic. I hope you enjoy this episode. And there is a very tangible call to action, something for us all to go and do during or after listening. So the idea is that you go and you find the constituency page. We'll explain it all to you during the episode, but you find the constituency page where you live on the Zero Hour website and you show your support. Now, I'm aware that we get quite technical in some parts of the podcast today, referencing lots of vaguely political stuff like the Paris Agreement and things like that we might all have heard of but might not feel fully up to speed on. So I've tried to include as many links to further information as possible in the show notes if you did want to go and check them out, and you can find them as usual on asustainablelife.co.uk/podcast. Enjoy, and I will catch you on the other side. Hello, both of you. Welcome to Sustainable-ish. Amy, can you kick us off and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks so much for having us on the podcast, Jen. We're really pleased to be with you here today. My name is Amy. I'm one of the co-directors, along with Oliver, of Zero Hour, which is the campaign calling for the Climate and Nature Bill. So this is new legislation that we're pushing in Parliament, trying to get as many MPs as possible to back this piece of legislation that would essentially mean that the UK is doing its fair share to be able to tackle the climate and nature crisis, and to be able to do so together while also involving people.
Amazing. And what's your background, Amy? How did you get into this?
My background is has been for a while engaging in climate and nature activism and campaigning. So I actually come from an academic arts background. I had a PhD from University of the Arts London, but through that I was doing lots of advocacy work and lots of pushing for raising awareness of the climate and ecological emergency through places like Tate Modern and others.
Oh, wow. Fascinating.
Yes, it was through that. And then also I had a period of time working with an MEP in the European Parliament.
Wow.
And like I said, getting involved a bit more in campaigning and activism on the ground in the UK, which led to the bill.
Amazing. And Oliver's sat there very quietly and very patiently. Oliver, can you introduce yourself?
Yep, sure. Thanks, Jen. I'm Oliver Sidorchuk, the other co-director of Zero Hour. I've had a background in sort of Westminster campaigning around,
Wow.
firstly around sort of democratic engagement and then poverty and the root causes of poverty. And I shifted into thinking about sustainability and the well-being of future generations. And that veered me into Zero Hour about 4 years ago. And yeah, Amy and I run the campaign, but we have a dedicated team of people pushing sort of grassroots levers as well as research, and the political work we do in Westminster and local councils around the UK.
Amazing. And so Amy gave us a sort of a brief run through of what Zero Hour is. Who was it, sort of the brainchild of the two of you, or was it somebody else's baby that you're now running, or how did it all get started, Oliver?
Well, this is probably a question for Amy, to be honest.
Oh, okay, got it. Amy, do you want to take over?
I can take over. So it was the brainchild actually of a group of individuals, some worldwide leading scientists, but as well as campaigners who'd been involved in the Big Ask campaign. So this was a campaign that was using sort of mass mobilizing, getting lots of people from all across society, as well as using a bill. So this proposal for new legislation, it's called a private members bill. So it means it's not pushed from the government, but pushed from backbench MPs up.
Right.
And this is a process that was very successful in leading to the Climate Change Act. And it was a campaign that was run out of Friends of the Earth. So we're running this model that we know it's a big, big aim, but we know it can work, and that it needs, yes, it needs us pushing away within Parliament and contacting MPs, but really a lot of our power. And a lot of the push and drive comes from getting partners involved, whether that's businesses, community groups, different organisations, and grassroots campaigners on the ground, councillors, getting everyone involved, because obviously we know it's everyone's problem essentially. Everyone is being impacted by this stuff, and also we all need to have a say in what the fair way forward is.
And so what is the ask of the Climate and Nature Bill? Because it's and I had to double check the name of the bill, because it's had a couple of different names, hasn't it? But Oliver, can you tell us what the specific legislation would involve?
Yes, so that's right. Our organisation is called Zero Hour. Zerohour.uk is the website. The bill has been introduced a couple of times now in each session of this parliament that started after the 2019 election. So there are sort of two routes that you can introduce these types of bills, once in through the House of Commons or the House of Lords, and we've tried both approaches
Okay.
to pull every lever. Caroline Lucas, a Green MP, has introduced the bill on two occasions. Lord Rupert Redesdale, a Lib Dem, has done so in the House of Lords. And in the House of Commons, following that, Olivia Blake introduced the bill. And most recently, on the 12th of March, Alex Sobel introduced the bill. The name of the bill has changed from the Climate and Ecological Emergency Bill that some people may remember. Through to sticking with the official name of the bill as it was tabled in Parliament, the Climate and Ecology Bill. And we, sort of on the advice of lots of different types of green campaigners, have updated that word ecology to nature, which sort of is a better descriptive word, but is also, resonates with hopefully a lot more people. I mean, in a nutshell, the bill is calling for a UK-wide joined up climate and nature strategy that is advised via a citizens' assembly to help us really set the UK on a path to tackling these global emergencies at the speed and depth that we're facing. So it has two principal targets around climate and, on the other hand, nature, to firstly make sure that the UK plays its full role transparently and accountably in terms of reducing emissions, and that's the whole scope of emissions, including carbon dioxide and methane and what have you. And on nature is around reversing the destruction of nature by the end of this very important decade. There are some other things in there around ending the use of fossil fuels and making sure that we take account of our global carbon and ecological footprints. But the crux of it is deciding together as a country how we tackle this just transition. Because at the minute, unfortunately, and we can maybe get onto this, we haven't locked our international agreements in law. So there's been two COP15s, COP15 in Paris, 2015, with the Paris Agreement, and more recently, the Biodiversity COP, which was around nature restoration. So we want to see those principal sort of North Star targets locked into UK law.
Well, because my understanding was that they were, because we were signatories on the Paris Agreement, and therefore that's a legally binding document. And I guess there's always lots of debate as to how legally binding or otherwise it is. But and then we had, I think I seem to remember lots of self-congratulatory backslapping. Weren't we one of the first countries to sort of set a net zero goal? But they, so those aren't legally binding. Is that correct? Go on, Amy. You go. I don't know if you want to dive in on this.
Yeah, so with the Paris Agreement, we have our nationally determined contributions. So we have to sort of state the direction that we're taking, but we're not legally obliged to do so. So I think that's the kicker with that one. And with the Climate Change Act, actually it hasn't updated to actually be in line with the last chance of 1.5. And obviously now we're incredibly close to saying that, okay, we have surpassed 1.5, and it's really important that we just don't keep shifting and shifting the goal, because obviously temperatures can't just keep increasing. It would be absolutely disastrous.
I'm just aware that we're using a lot of terms that people may or may not be familiar with, or in a lot of terms that people have probably heard but might not have kind of be massively familiar with. And we did, I'll point people back to, and I should know if I was a good podcaster what episode number it was, but we did a sort of Climate 101 basics with Adam Levy, where we talked about a lot of the sort of 1.5 degree and the 2 degree and things. So people can go back and listen to that. But the Paris Agreement, I don't know who wants to jump in on that and just give us like a couple of sentences on what that is and what it means.
Yeah, I'm happy to do that. I mean, we're not an ideological organization, so we don't push particular policies. We're trying to ensure that UK climate and nature policy is aligned with the science. So definitely there is a lot out there on the importance of these international treaties and what the IPCC, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change talks about. But the headline that people talk about a lot in terms of the Paris Agreement is this 1.5, or well below 2 degrees of warming. That can be interpreted in different ways by countries, and the UK advisors to the government, the Climate Change Committee, set out different pathways for the UK to reach what. And you're quite right, the UK government has locked that in law, a sort of 2050 net zero target. One of the things that we're trying to do is to join the dots up between that net zero date, and there's lots of controversy about that, and the UK's proportionate share of the global or remaining global carbon budget for the Paris Agreement.
That term carbon budget is quite interesting as well. Like, because I guess we're all familiar with the idea of a financial budget, and we have this amount of money coming in and therefore this amount of money to spend. How does a carbon budget work? And you sort of have talked a few times about the UK's share of that. Can you just sort of talk to that a little bit, Amy?
Yeah, essentially there's a global carbon budget, which means basically it's the amount of emissions that we can put into the atmosphere before we reach certain temperatures.
So on
So
the sort of climate scientists' models, they'll know that a certain amount of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases results in a certain amount of temperature rise. They know where we are now. They know what we want to keep it under, and that's the chunk of greenhouse gases we've got left, essentially.
exactly. So we see it as a pie.
Right. So like always like a pie or a cake analogy.
Exactly, we love a pie. And that the UK obviously has a fair share, so we think about its proportionate fair share of keeping at global temperatures, because obviously everybody needs to be reducing. It's all one atmosphere, and we're not actually an island. We're all very, very interconnected. So it's really critical that we do our fair share to keep at those temperatures, and then lead the way and show leadership so that others are doing the same.
Yeah, because a lot of people, and I'm sure you guys will hear this all the time, and I hear it a lot, will say there's no point in the UK doing anything. Look at us, we're tiny, our emissions, and therefore, it's all on China. It's all on, well, usually people say China and India and just quietly omit the US, who are like one of the massive historical and currently biggest emitters. What is, let's play devil's advocate. What is the point of us doing anything?
Well, there's a couple of things to think about in that respect. I mean, the UK also has a massive historical responsibility as, the place where the Industrial
Yes.
Revolution kicked off. That type of retrospective look today isn't really something that lots of people want to talk about in politics, because, as you say, the UK has its relative share. But there's also another factor to consider that we do incorporate into the bill, which is consumption emissions.
Yeah.
Lots of the things that we consume, and we know that we consume a lot of things that we don't need, that aren't repaired and are produced in these countries that are the bigger emitters. I mean, then another sort of inconvenient truth is that those countries are often leading the way in terms of the pivot to renewables that
Oh, China, are like their renewable capacity that they've installed just in the last year has been phenomenal, I think, hasn't it?
it is. And it's, we're a UK-based campaign. Our influence, if we can exert it, and constituency influence and voters' influence, is on UK politicians. But as Amy was mentioning, this is a global fight, and the UK really ought to be showing the leadership that is often touted, and the rhetoric is often out there. So that's why the Climate and Nature Bill talks about emissions in the round, net imports, international aviation and shipping, because it's going to be even harder to properly address this issue, given all the uncertainty about 1.5, whether it's been passed or not, without being open and honest about the scale of the problem that we face.
When we passed the sort of the net zero legislation in I think it was 2019, we were one of the first countries to do that, and other countries then followed suit. And I feel like at the moment that there's an awful lot of people just sitting around pointing fingers at, well, there's no point us doing anything, what about China? Well, there's no point us doing anything, what about them? And actually, we need to stop pointing fingers and waiting for someone else to do something. And the more countries that stand up and show this, it's about being seen to act, isn't it? And I talk about this on an individual level as well. It's about being seen to act as, in addition to what you actually do. And that's so important, I think, on an international stage, isn't it? Especially when it feels like a lot of the political discussion is about rowing back, and that almost gives other countries then permission to slow down and those sorts of things. So yeah, this could be huge in not only UK emissions reductions and impact on nature, but that international piece as well. So super important. So would this legislation replace, I'm just going to say names here, and I know very little about them. So I think you mentioned on the website like the Environment Act, and I think you've already mentioned the Climate Change Act. Would it replace those pieces of legislation, or is it in addition to? How does that work? Amy, are you the, I don't know who's the historic legislation expert?
We both do our best.
Yes.
I think that there are several ways that this could actually come into law, and one would be that it's this umbrella piece of legislation that sort of ties up a lot of the work that the Environment Act and the Climate Change Act are doing, and to make sure essentially we're making sure that these pieces of legislation, that the legislation we have in the UK is in line with the ambition of what the latest science is telling us. So yeah, I think this is what we're doing. So whether it's whether it's sort of updating and upgrading those pieces of legislation to ensure that's the case and making sure they speak to each other, or whether it's a piece of legislation in its own right. I think there are two routes that we could go to there. But yeah, the important thing really is making sure that we have this joined up plan, that we're uniting our response to climate and nature, because I mean, we say this a lot, but nature is our best ally in the fight against climate change. And without boosting biodiversity, without making sure that nature is healthy, then we really cannot avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So in terms of mitigation, drawing down, but also thinking about flooding and sort of heat stress as well.
Yeah, and I still, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, still haven't done an episode on biodiversity, and I'm super aware of that, and just to have like one episode dedicated to biodiversity when actually, as you said, biodiversity and nature underpins everything else and is so incredibly important. And I think we as a general population still see nature as a nice fluffy, nice to have, a nice add-on, a nice to look at, and don't really understand how important it is. And Amy, you just sort of alluded to it a little bit there, but Oliver, what's the it sounds silly to say, but I guess, but like, why did you decide to call this like the climate and nature, or make sure really make a point of including ecology and nature in the bill?
I think the rationale behind it is that we face, and you can look at these issues through multiple lenses, but ultimately, we do have to think about this policy in a dual way. These are two intertwined crises. Some people add a third leg to the stool around pollution or perhaps farming, but these things from the perspective of the scientists that we're working with, and I think the global agreed sort of nature of the challenge or the crises rather that we face is climate and nature. Our third leg to the stool is involving citizens, so that's the way that the bill is structured. But there is no point tackling these intertwined issues in silos. We're honest about the challenge that this type of bill presents policymakers, because it is unusual for legislation to cross-cut or cut across policy like this. Westminster is a very, very difficult place, Whitehall, to do the joined-up thinking between departments, and we can see that across everything. But one of the ways that we found effective to campaign for this bill, this legislation, is to think about those cross-cutting issues like health. It would be very easy, in a way, to campaign on this through a health lens, because whether it's air pollution or the impact of wildfires, one of our partners, the Doctors Association UK, has been leaning on Steve Barclay, who was then in the sort of environment minister at the time. But Zach Goldsmith, for example, when he was environment minister, did some very interesting work on this with the two UN level bodies around biodiversity and climate. I think one of the ministers from one of the Scandinavian countries was saying, you either do both or you do neither. So it really is something that politicians have to think much more holistically about.
Do
Yeah.
you think politicians get it? Like, there was a, I can't even remember when it was now, but an amazing guy called Angus Rose, who went on hunger strike outside the UK Parliament to try and ensure that all MPs had a scientific briefing on, I think it was on the health impact specifically of climate change, in the same way that they had those COVID briefings. And he was successful, but like literally 10% of MPs turned up. And I, emailed my MP and said, "Are you going to go?" And he went, "No, I'm not going to go." And I just feel like, I mean, I run carbon literacy training, and so this is like 8 hours worth of training, giving everybody like the basics of climate science and where we're heading. And I just feel like that should be compulsory for our MPs. I don't feel, and maybe I'm being naive, but there's part of me that thinks if they understood what was at stake, what would they take action? I don't know. I hope they would, but I don't know. Like, do you get a sense that MPs get it, both from a climate or a nature perspective? Yeah, I think it's really challenging. It's interestingly, I think a law has just passed in Argentina that would mean that it's that politicians there have to have a certain amount of training or a
That's
certain
super
amount of
interesting because
knowledge
hasn't
before
Argentina
they're
just gone
filtered.
massively right wing?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that's the case, to be honest, and it's something we just got wind of yesterday, so we should check
Wow. Yeah.
that out. And yeah, really fascinating if that is the case. So there is a lot of potential there, and I know there's been a lot of research that's been carried out between Green Alliance and the University of Lancaster, where they've carried out interviews with MPs. They carried them out in 2018 and recently as well, really thinking about what the knowledge base is and how willing MPs are to act. And I think one change that has happened over the past few years is that there's a great, much greater acknowledgement that there is a crisis, that it's threatening humanity. So these big terms, which is really important. But we are trapped within a certain political system. And I think until MPs are really feeling the pressure in their constituencies, then often they have so many competing issues to get to grips with. And we really, so much energy, but we really all do need to keep on at them and keeping making sure that this issue is at the forefront of MPs' minds. I think the climate issue people are a lot more aware of. I think there's still a lot more, so I'm really pleased that you're doing an episode potentially on biodiversity because there's a lot less awareness of how nature ties in, and the sort of sense that it's a fluffier, nice to have. I think it's a lot harder for some reason for the message to sink in that actually, as Oliver was starting to say, it's not only about tackling climate change. It is the air we breathe. It's also the food we eat and having healthy soils to be able to produce food, create food security, health, well-being, and also thinking about green jobs and resilient jobs. So the jobs that will be required in the future, all of these things tie in together. So I think that's part of the job that the bill is doing, is to ensure that the protection of nature is actually really threaded through decision making.
And I mean you'd sort of from a political perspective, and the UK is not unique in this, I think it's global, like this net zero target of 2050 is like I heard it described as Latin for kicking the can down the road. Like, and we've got these 4 or 5 year election cycles, and it's, if we're trying to be empathetic, we can put ourselves in a politician's shoes and say, I understand how difficult it is to push through these changes that on the surface might feel very expensive, might feel like they're going to impact on jobs in your particular region, all these sorts of things. But longer term, they're going to save us a huge amount of money. We need to boost the green economy, all those sorts of things. But I can absolutely understand why it's difficult, but it's not a system that works for these longer term things. And is that I really like the part of the bill where you've talked about a climate and nature assembly. So if people hadn't heard of that sort of process before, Oliver, can you just explain what that involves?
Yeah, but I think you're absolutely right. You know, the stranglehold of these 4 year terms, any long term planning hard to do. You know, take HS2 as an example, completely cross party platform. Whatever you think about it, sort of the destruction of nature that went with it, as an example. And there are some instances of countries around the world trying to think about climate plans as constitutional issues that
I
climate.
was going to say, I think I've vaguely heard people talk about the fact that this should be just taken away from government and an apolitical issue and is just like its own thing that runs on regardless of who's in charge.
I mean, it's interesting how often that is said about a host of issues,
Yes, actually. Education, health, anything.
which is all the more reason to think about bolstering our democratic processes with things like citizens' juries, citizens' assemblies, to make MPs' lives easier. You know, this is not about taking away the sovereignty of the UK Parliament. And I know there's lots of debate about the role of citizens' assemblies and their sovereignty. It's very good to see Sue Gray in the Labour Party talking about it. It's very promising that.
What are citizens' assemblies for people who haven't heard of them before?
So citizens' assemblies are a way of getting sort of a representative group of individuals to come together to think about policies in Northern Ireland, for example. I think there's been them on abortion and perhaps equal marriage.
I think that might have been in Republic of Ireland, wasn't it? The abortion one, yeah.
Yes, Republic of Ireland, exactly. They've been done through and commissioned by UK parliamentary committees. So there was a climate assembly commissioned by six UK select committees, where experts are able to come in, give people the evidence. There's a sort of structured discussion about the types of recommendations and policies that should flow from them. The teeth is always the question when it turns into a political decision. So
No,
what?
that was the frustration around the climate assembly, because it happened, it was sort of in the run up to COVID, wasn't it? And then I think there was some, they had to go virtual for some of it, but I don't know if it's still on iPlayer, but there was a brilliant documentary, which was, what was it? It was like the People versus Climate Change or something, wasn't it? And it sort of followed, they obviously picked interesting characters and they followed them through the process. And as you said, there's, I can't remember if it was 100 people, and they're picked to be a demographic representation of the UK. And so there were people on there, at the start who were like, yeah, not bothered about it. Or I remember one girl who was like, oh, I go on like 5 holidays a year, short haul flights and all this sort of thing. And one guy who was sailor, and he was like, well, what does it matter if sea level rises and all these? And it was so interesting to follow their personal journey through and see how it changed by having that information delivered to them in an accessible way, having an opportunity to discuss it changed their mindsets. And actually, what came out of it was far more ambitious than, their recommendations were far more ambitious than I think potentially people were expecting. But then the massive frustration that the government just went, all right, thanks for that. Like, oh my God, like, why spend all that money doing it and then completely ignore it? You've got that, as you said, it gives you that mandate for change where politicians can almost, do a Brexit and go, the country has spoken, like, we will follow through on this. Like, it takes the, they're not being seen to be making the wrong decision or whatever. I just don't get why they haven't followed through on it. Do you guys got any insight on that? It's hugely frustrating.
Yeah, well, just going back to your first points, I think, yeah, there's such interesting processes, and the fact that, they're randomly selected, so randomly selected from all around the UK if it's a UK-based assembly, and then made representatives. So whether that means from certain regions or age groups or whatever, the
Across
different
all
sort of segments.
socio-economic factors and
Yes,
all that sort of thing, wasn't it? And racial
exactly
profiles and
that.
yeah.
Exactly that. And so what a privilege to get a
Yeah.
group of people like that together. And when do you ever get to do so? And I think particularly now, and probably we'll see this more and more in the election build up, but we're in such a divisive society
Yes,
as
and
we
we
know.
only have our bubble that we hear from and listen to.
Exactly. Yeah, that's really, really fueled by the way we communicate, that's fueled by the politics of our time. So now more than ever, it's actually really critical that we do involve people, and that we involve people from all different walks of life. And that actually, as you say, when given the facts, when given the evidence, people do tend to actually make really sensible decisions. We've seen that. We've seen that with Ireland, with these really key new directions for the country to take in a Catholic country, thinking about abortion law, thinking about
Well, it would be a real political hot potato, I imagine, which is why
hot
they went
potatoes.
over to you guys.
Exactly. And I think that's what citizens' assemblies are actually really good at, is exactly dealing with those hot potatoes, and helping really smooth the way for politicians to take the difficult decisions, or the decisions that will impact people's lifestyles. And of course, so it's critical actually that the public really understand, and that they're really taken on that journey, with everyone else.
And I think sometimes politicians' perceptions of what people think is skewed by this very vocal minority, by reporting in the press who potentially have hidden agendas and all those sorts of things. And so, they're in their own little bubbles of what they're hearing and listening to. And the people might have heard of Rupert Reid's got this climate majority project going on, hasn't he? And so actually, all the studies show 70-80% of people are worried, and actually, if we can galvanize those people to become more vocal and all those sorts of things. But how, I don't know if, again, if I'm just sort of in this bubble and have sort of started tuning into the wrong feeds on social media and things, but It feels to me like politically we're almost moving in the wrong direction. It felt like there was a real momentum around COP26, around when we had all the school strikes and all those sorts of things, and when we had that net zero bill, and it felt like things were still moving too slowly, but we were kind of moving in the right direction. And now it feels really like the government are intentionally trying to make this a wedge issue, a divisive issue, and that. I don't know. And again, I don't know if this is, and that public opinion is, I don't know, starting to wane. Have you guys found or come across any of that in the work that you're doing?
I think that's a really interesting timeline to chart up to and beyond COP26. I mean, I think the Prime Minister's U-turn following the Uxbridge by-election is also a really interesting moment to think about. I think the Labour candidate possibly would have won if the other minority parties had gone in behind them, which is, you know, an example of our broken past the post system. But that moment, I think. And we'd have to sort of think about this in the round, but triggered then Rishi Sunak's U-turns around boilers and electric cars. I mean, the fallout from that was huge, you know. But for him, was I think a mistake in the sense that I think it was Jaguar Land Rover who just invested a lot of money.
And I think Ford were really cross about it as well, weren't they? There was a lot,
People want certainty, you know. When we launched our general election campaign earlier this month. Was at the end of last month, sorry. Deborah Meaden, Dragon's Den star, was talking about the need for consistency and certainty for business. So, you know, never mind talking about the joined up crisis, jobs, food. You know, you would think an audience that the government would be interested in keeping happy are people investing in the economy. So it's a really dangerous gamble to take politically. I mean, there's all that nonsense that as well about sort of Labour's meat tax, these things, you know, seven bins. You know, I think you ask people who've lived through something like a wildfire or a flood, or their farm is deteriorating, or they don't see any wildlife anymore, or their child has asthma. You know, these are climate and nature issues. It was a little bit disappointing, I think, to see something about Sadiq Khan, who's been very strong on sticking to his ULEZ plans. But I think we need some bravery from politicians to say and continue to do the right thing. And the Mayor of London backs the bill, and he's been very, very good on ULEZ, I think, because it's a very brave decision to take. But you know, there is a very vocal minority amplified by a press that is funded, as you said, by perhaps not very positive forces that make very clickable social media bits. We all know the stations that they are. They're often not regulated very well. But all the more reason to keep pushing the message locally that there are immense co-benefits for this stuff. It's not about, you know, wool, hair, shirts, or whatever the phrase is. You know, this type of stuff can improve your life in a big way.
I'm very aware that I probably just bang this drum on every podcast episode, but the storytelling has been off on our part for as a sort of climate space has been bad. So, we haven't the story, we've allowed the narrative to be dominated by the, this is going to be awful. You won't be able to fly. The narrative around 15-minute cities, all that like absolute ridiculous stuff. And actually, if we talk about those co-benefits, particularly around health, that they're enormous. And actually, just in terms of what we want out of our lives and the joy and the connectivity, like we could really go, or we, I don't know how, but we could really go hard on that. And it needs some really clever creatives and things to kind of get behind that, doesn't it? But so you mentioned the sort of election campaign, and we're very aware that potentially before January, I think we've got to have an election at some point. Probably not looking, well, it's not going to be May now, is it? But maybe November, I think, is that the next sort of most likely date? But what's the election campaign asking us to do or aiming to do?
So no, we're really excited about our election campaign, and as we've been saying, I think now is the time to dig in more than ever and make sure that politicians really have a mandate to call for bold climate and nature action, and the action that we need to see that's in line with the science. So what we're doing is really helping to network and galvanize collective action within constituencies. And we've created what we're calling constituency action pages. So it means that you can type in your postcode
I
wherever
totally want to
you're.
go and do that now, but I need to sit on my hands.
Yeah, you can go to action.zerohour.uk, and you'll find the page there. It's really simple. Put in your postcode, and then you have your page for your constituency. And the exciting thing is that it really will keep building, and it really shows all the different actors within your local area that are getting involved and calling for change. So whether that's councils who've passed motions, whether it's local businesses, organisations, community groups who are signing up, as well as individual constituents who are all calling on candidates to back the Climate and Nature Bill, and to champion it within the next parliament.
So the idea is that then you could go to your MP and go have a look at this and see how many businesses and community groups and all that sort of thing want this. Because as you said, politicians will only change if they feel like they have a mandate for it, because as you mentioned, Sadiq Khan, like it's a big, often a big brave thing to do that can feel like it's flying in the face of public opinion when actually it probably isn't. But
Exactly. Yeah, we're approaching all candidates. So the idea is to make sure that your next MP is already backing the bill and backing bold action.
because it's all very well campaigning to your current MP, but they may not be your MP in a year's time.
Exactly. I mean, it will be amazing to think whenever this election is, May, June, October, November, whenever. We've been very quick to get out the traps with this campaign. It's really simple to do. So just head to the Zero Hour website to do it. But
And
also, we
can you sort of sign as an individual as well, or do you need to be part
yeah.
of a bigger thing?
No, absolutely. So it's about individual campaigners on the one hand, that sort of support mandate, but also the threat of turnout. Politicians are in listening mode. They should be in listening mode all the time, but elections, for some reason, there is pricked
Job's on
up.
the line.
And there could be a huge turnover of seats this time.
Yeah.
But as Amy was saying, if you can sign up as an individual, if you're a member of any local organizations, a faith group, some sort of community group,
Yeah.
the more the merrier, because we're trying to create little hubs of activity. Thinking also about places where we want to have a focus. We've got some targets that we'll be sharing very soon, maybe doing some hustings. So if people are really, really keen, your listeners, to get involved as a volunteer organization, really, they should get in touch.
Yeah. So is the idea that you get enough people, or you show MPs and prospective MPs this sort of mandate for change, so that when the new parliament is in place, you guys can then go in hard with the process of getting the bill passed? Because, like, I think did it first get introduced in like September 2020, and it's just, I with all of the climate stuff and nature stuff, it like the clock is ticking, isn't it? Like, we've now got 6 years left until 2030, which is such a crucial decade in terms of emissions and for nature. Like, how quickly could the bill come into place? Is it now like nothing's going to happen until the next election, and then it's going hard after that? Is that how the sort of timeline?
I mean, I can start, and I'm sure Oliver will want to jump in as well. Yeah, we have really critical time frames now. I mean, obviously that's been the case for a long while, but we really believe that this is the last election before the last
Yeah.
government in power, really, where we can make sure that we don't head over really critical tipping points and lose control. I mean, the current government have said that over 1.5 we could lose control of climate for good. So this is absolutely the last chance saloon.
That's what's so terrifying about Trump and stuff in the States, isn't it? Like, oh God.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it really does involve everyone getting involved, and a really big effort to sort of turn this around and make sure that politicians are acting on our behalf in this way. So yeah, I think, and as a movement, I also think this is the last chance that we have to be able to push for the legislation we need. It's really critical because we have the legislation that we have. But if we're not aiming in line with what the science is telling us, then we're still in a really dangerous position. So that's something that the bill is really calling for that's incredibly important.
What, how does it hook up with like we've had an episode on the commitment, which is another thing that's sort of asking people to go and, you know, make a commitment to say that they will be voting for politicians who have climate and nature sort of front of mind. And Greenpeace are doing a big, and I always get it wrong, is it Operation Climate Vote or Operation Vote Climate?
I think it's Project Climate Vote, I think.
And are you guys all kind of like talking to each other, or there must be, there's a lot of crossover, isn't there?
There's a lot, and you know, there will be different pledges and hustings and campaigns going on. I mean, ours is a relatively low bar of entry. We are talking and work very closely with lots of groups that, you know, do door knocking and events and groups. But you know, this is a relatively easy thing to do, but the impact could be very, very large if lots of us get behind it. So, you know, you've got a chance to make sure that your main candidate standing to be your next MP understand how you feel about this. That's not to say you shouldn't be doing other things. We know everyone is very time poor. So the things that you can do like this to remind your candidates that, you know, these are emergencies that we face. You know, politicians often want to talk about these things wrapped up around jobs and energy bills and energy independence, for example, with climate. And those are important levers to pull and important ways to get MPs to listen. But what we're trying to do is to remind people that this isn't something that the UK Parliament has taken seriously. You know, we're coming up to 5 years since the House of Commons declaring a climate emergency. Lots of people in the NGO space have worked incredibly hard on the Conservative government's post-Brexit legislation, agriculture, environment, fisheries, all sorts of stuff. But, and this is where I think our campaign, Zero Hour, serves its key purpose, is to be that thorn in the side and say, you know, there is a difference between the ambition that's required with the science and what politicians put in the politically possible or feasible or acceptable box. And as you were saying, Jen, you know, if people deem that these aren't vote winners and people aren't making their voices heard, then it's really easy to just say, sorry, you know, we're doing what we can, China, India, America, and then it's that slippery slope.
Yeah, I mean, it's so frustrating, isn't it? And a lot of people are very frustrated about, I mean, you mentioned, Oliver, I think that sort of our political system and some things, you know, I'm in an incredibly safe Tory seat. I will be amazed. Although I did see some polling that he would, you know, he could lose it. But I guess this is one way of making your voice heard in addition to how you vote. And I think anything we can do to give people a voice is hugely important, isn't it? I think am I right in saying there's like 150 MPs supporting the bill at the moment? I did an interview with Steve Shaw, I think, is it, at Power for People, and he's got this local electricity bill going, or hopefully going through. It just seems like such a glacially slow process. And he was sort of explaining on the episode, you know, how it works, that you have to have an MP who introduces the bill, and then it needs a certain number of MPs to support it before it gets passed, and all those sorts of things. Like, how, this feels like such a mean question. How realistic does it feel to you guys that this will get through?
I think, yeah, these processes can seem really arcane and
So we
frustrating.
could
So,
spend another 6 years fannying about talking about it, and then it's like, oh, it's 2030 now.
I really think that. And you know, it has taken a while, and it does take a while to build up support for these things. So, we've got 180 different cross-party
Oh,
MPs
brilliant.
and peers at the moment. and that cross-party messaging. I think, however, we're going to vote, this has to be a bit sort of past politics as
Yes.
well. We're within this political system, but it has to be that everyone understands the importance behind this, and it's far greater than the sort of messaging of any given political party. And that's a really important thing to bear in mind. But yeah, we've got this group of cross-party MPs and peers, which is actually the largest environmental platform of cross-party MPs and peers in Parliament. So that's a really important thing that we've set in place, as well as all the backing, like we said, from business.
Got some good celeb backing as well, haven't you?
Yeah, business
Drop some names,
NGO.
drop some names.
Yeah, we're building up lots of support from people like Chris Packham, Oliver
Yes.
mentioned Deborah Meaden earlier on, as well as activists like Tori Chewi and others. So we are really building that support as well, and really creating this sense of a groundswell, which is really, really important. And we know that the Big Ask campaign, radio had got involved, and Thom Yorke, and that was a really good push point. So yeah, you can't knock the power of celebrity and getting out one message.
I mean, Steve Shaw has done an amazing job with Power for People, and shows the importance of grassroots networks.
Yes.
So whilst it's really important to make a splash and to get as many people involved, it's just a reminder, I suppose, that these types of campaigns work when constituents apply pressure repeatedly
Yes.
on their individual MPs. Everyone likes a good stunt. It's incredibly hard to get these types of issues into the
Yeah.
media. If we issued a press release, saying, something, derogatory about
Yes, yeah.
that might get picked up. The
Yeah.
hard work is maintaining cross-party consensus on this stuff. But it's just, I guess, a reminder that we should keep pushing the people that are there to represent us, whether it's parish council, MP, whether you're in a Scottish Parliament or the Parliament or the London Assembly or wherever, that these issues matter. And it might help to have, Gary Lineker tweeting out a video, and we'd love that.
Gary, if you're
If you're out
listening.
there, yeah, exactly. If you're out there, Gary.
But it's super important that people think about this in their local communities and their collective, whether it's work, place of religion.
So if you're working for a business, which most people are, or even if you're a business leader, like, I don't know, Joe Bloggs repair shop, they can sign up as an org. It doesn't have to be a kind of Unilever or a Boots or a
Oh,
big practice. We could, a big organization. We
yeah.
could have little independent businesses and things signing
Yeah.
up.
That'd be
Yeah,
amazing.
that's.
I mean, I think there's probably more power in a
Yeah.
local garage leaning
Yes.
on MP, or the sort of local pet shop or then coffee shop. Businesses are especially powerful,
Yes. Yeah.
and there is also that sort of general rule of thumb. If 10 people write to an MP,
Yes.
perhaps 1,000 people care.
Is that what it is? Because that, and
Or
that's quite
something.
motivating, because I will sort of periodically email my MP, but I'm sure I'm on a blacklist now. I'm sure my emails just go straight like into either into spam or just get this automatic, and then he'll reply to me with some very lengthy, very wordy thing that tells me how wonderfully the Tory party are doing that I then don't feel qualified enough to respond to and tear apart. But it can feel like a waste of time because he knows what he's going to get from me.
Yeah.
And I guess that's where the power of campaigns like this that bring people together, so they're hearing these voices being amplified. Just aware of time, like I said to you right at the beginning, like I love a call to action at the end of the podcast. So I love the idea of people listening and then feeling like they can go and do something. What do we want people to do for this campaign?
Yeah, I think we really want people to remember that actually their voice is really important, and like you're saying, even more so. Even if you feel like you've written to your MP, you've got a set response back. You feel that on your own, you aren't heard. I mean, this is the beauty of these constituency action pages, is that it really draws together the collective power within your local area and within your constituency. So we really urge people to go to action.zerohour.uk to
Amazing.
sign up on their constituency page, but then have a think about the networks that you're in, whether it's sharing it with your friends and
Yes.
family, whether it's sharing it with your colleagues, whether things like parent groups,
Yes.
things like running clubs, all of these different organizations are incredibly powerful and will definitely make a difference.
I'm
We
just wondering
have
if
a
you could get
bill.
like NHS trusts and those sorts of things, because lots of, the NHS got really ambitious sustainability plans, hasn't it? Net zero plans and things, and that we know that intersection between health and climate is so
Yeah,
important.
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's useful having a think yourself about who your local celebrities are, or
Yes.
who your candidates might listen to, who the unusual suspects
Yes.
might be. And it's actually quite fun to start thinking and strategizing in your local area about this stuff.
Yeah, so you can sign individually, and then you can have a think about, oh, I wonder if I could get the chair of our running group to sign, and I wonder if I could get the local GP surgery to sign up, and I wonder if I could get it. So, and then you can kind of send out a little flurry of emails. Have you got any like templates or anything that help people to email other people to get them on board?
Yeah, we've got a campaigner pack on our website, zerohour.uk. We also host sort of check-in sessions for people to come with questions or share tips. But we're also here, we've got a small but very active team of grassroots sort of support. So if people have questions, they can email us. We don't have an office or a phone, we're all quite remote, so we don't do that. But we also have a WhatsApp community where people can ask very specific
Oh,
questions
brilliant.
in general. So that's all in our campaigner pack on the website.
Fabulous. And I will link to that as well. Have you got any kind of like specific goals for like pre-election in terms of number of people signing up or anything like that? Or are you just kind of like, we'll take whatever we can get? Go on, Amy.
Yeah, definitely. I think the goal is to get the majority of candidates who are likely to win. So that's what we're thinking about. So that we know that the next parliamentary intake, we want to make sure when everyone comes in, sort of fresh-faced or not, as the case may be, that those individuals are there ready to take proper action, that they've already signed up, that they already have put their name to backing this really important
Ah, so when you say get
legislation.
prospective candidates, you want those people to have, can't remember the correct term, but as like you say, you've got MPs supporting the bill. You want them to be already supporting the bill as they come in, so to be able to show them the groundswell of support from their new constituency, as it may be, and then they can come in and hit the ground running.
Exactly that. And I think, thinking about time frames that we mentioned before, that will really allow us to hit the ground running. If you have the majority of MPs backing a piece of legislation, it's something that the government just won't be able to ignore. And I think that's a really important piece of the puzzle that we're working on with this campaign.
Amazing. Oh, thank you so much, guys. A for like, I mean, I'm always so in awe of everybody who comes on the podcast in terms of the work that they're doing, and I'm sure there are lots of like personal sacrifices in terms of the time it takes you, and usually working for low or very or minimal or even no pay a lot of the time, and those sorts of things. So hugely, there is a donate button actually mentioning that, isn't there, on your website as support for crowdfunding campaign. So yeah, thank you to you guys on a very personal level for the work that you're doing, and for this, like, it's so super important. And thank you for your time coming on as well. It's been super, super interesting.
Thank you, Jen. Thank you for all you're doing too. It's really
Oh,
inspiring.
it feels tiny, tiny, tiny compared to what you're doing, but thank you very much. That's super kind.
Lovely.
Thanks so much, Jen.
So, I think it's going to be fairly obvious what I'm going to ask you to go and do now, isn't it? That's right. No prizes for guessing. Head over to the Zero Hour website, which is at zerohour.uk. Have a little nose around, and then make sure you don't leave without heading to the action part of the website. The action is the all-important bit of any of this. Action.zerohour.uk, and you just pop in your postcode. It will bring up your constituency page. You can see how many other people have signed, and then you can sign to show your support as well. And then Have a think about who you could share it with, whether that's friends and family, work colleagues, local businesses, churches, running groups, schools. The list is endless. Let's see if we can really spread some ripples with this one. Okay, that is all from me for this week. I have got hot cross buns to eat and a simnel cake in the oven. Have a marvellous Easter weekend. If you do get a moment in between scoffing Easter eggs and you've enjoyed this episode, then please do leave a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts, and I will catch you next time. Take care.